Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Global Ethics and Politics. I'm John McMahon, PhD candidate in political theory at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and one of the hosts of the channel. I'm also a fellow at the Center for Global Ethics and Politics, which sponsors the podcast and is part of the Ralph Bunche Institute at the Graduate Center. Today I'm speaking with Nicolas Versalles, who's assistant professor in political philosophy at Leiden University in the Netherlands, and also this year the Lawrence S. Rockefeller Visiting Faculty Fellow at the Center for Human Values at Princeton. We're discussing his book, The Political Philosophy of G.A. Cohen, Back to Socialist Basics, out from Bloomsbury in 2015. In the book, Versalles engages in a thorough reconstruction of a unified approach to thinking through G.A. Cohen's political philosophy. Versalles traces various different strands of Cohen's work, from his Marxism to his work on distributive justice and in other areas of moral and political philosophy, to work on exploitation, the market, and socialism. The result is a fascinating critical engagement with this important thinker, and ultimately it also enables one to get a sense of the debates that Cohen is engaged in and the arguments of his interlocutors, people like Rawls and Dworkin, Sen, and many others. Ultimately, the book, and I hope this interview, offers a new, fresh approach to addressing and engaging with the work of G.A. Cohen, and, as Versalles argues, also Cohen's method, his polemical method of immanent critique and engaging and questioning one's own principles and positions. I highly urge everybody to go out and get their hands on a copy of this book. It's an important read. It's a challenging read. It's an impressive in the way that Versalles is able to, on the one hand, view Cohen's work as a whole, and on the other hand, trace the various threads and oftentimes tensions within Cohen's overall project. The result is something that challenges us to rethink our own beliefs about the market, about fairness, freedom, equality, socialism in philosophical thought and also in our contemporary political moment. I hope you enjoy the interview. Joining me now is Nicolas Versalles, assistant professor in political philosophy at Leiden University in the Netherlands, and also this year the Lawrence S. Rockefeller Visiting Faculty Fellow at the Center for Human Values at Princeton. He's also the author of The Political Philosophy of G.A. Cohen, Back to Socialist Basics, out from Bloomsbury in 2015. Nicolas, thank you so much for joining us on New Books in Global Ethics and Politics.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
We were talking about before, a pleasure to read the book and really kind of approach Cohen in this very kind of comprehensive way. So I'm looking forward to the conversation. And to start, I'll ask you the traditional question here on the podcast, and that is, if you could tell us some about your academic background and how you came to write this book, and perhaps also some about what it was like to work with Cohen.
Sure, yeah. I studied economics as an undergrad, and then I decided at some point I wanted to shift to philosophy. I was interested in Marxism, and so I went to Oxford to study with Cohen, who had published a very influential text in 1978 on Marxist theory of history, and that's where I encountered the rich world of moral and political philosophy, and this brought me to where I am now, which is working on things in the in this conceptual vicinity. So Marxism, theories of exploitation, theories of power, theories of inequality, and so on. And so eventually, while I was a graduate student, I worked with Cohen, with Jerry, as most people who knew him called him. You know, there were two Cohens. There was the the G.A. Cohen, who was the formidable and you know, very, very tough analytic philosopher that everyone met in the seminar room. And then there was Jerry Cohen, who was the person who was outside the seminar room, who was a very funny, very approachable, very humane human being. So anyway, I worked with Jerry, and when Jerry passed in 2009, I experienced it as a sort of existential necessity that I would put together something that combines the analytical approach to philosophy that Jerry taught me with an attempt to bring together and unite all the disparate strands of Cohen's philosophy into one unified narrative.
Sure. And that's why for you then was it important to, as you said, approach the unity of Cohen's thought? I mean, what about that particular project was so important for you?
Yeah, part of the reason, of course, is psychological for me. I wanted to, as it were, sort out the ideas that were in my head, not just vis-a-vis Cohen's thought, but also where I myself stood vis-a-vis Cohen's political philosophy and you know, his extremely influential writings on equality, fraternity, Marx, exploitation, power, and so on. But also, what's important here is that Cohen himself didn't see himself as putting together a massive philosophical edifice like Kant or Hegel or Rawls or Marx. He didn't think of himself as a system builder. He thought of himself more as a critic. And that made for a brilliant set of polemical essays and books that he published throughout his life, but he never really attempted to bring them together into a unified whole. And that's what the book tries to do.
I would say it does so quite successfully. And as we get into the book, you introduce Cohen's overall project by terming it as a secular egalitarian theodicy. So could you tell us what you mean by framing Cohen in that way and how doing so helps us think through the broader unity of his work?
Sure, yeah. Cohen inherits from German idealism the philosophy of Kant, Hegel, Kant and Hegel, and also from Marxist materialism, this idea that this rather commitment to a fully free and fully emancipated humanity, and inherits also from it this notion that humanity has to go through a set of stages that involve suffering and pain before it can reach the stage of full emancipation. And so this is important because it is through this kind of theodicy or theodicial, if you like, motif that Cohen arrives at his Marxism. His Marxism is the Marxism of the Second International, which consists in the idea that social change is determined by changes in technology. And as technology develops and grows, so do social relations and what Marxists call the relations of production, that is, relations of power in society. And so humanity has to undergo go through this capitalist veil of tears, as he calls it, this period of suffering and exploitation and domination, before it can get to the fully emancipated stage of socialism. And there is clearly here a slightly theological motif that Marx inherited from Hegel, and the Marxist tradition inherits from Marx.
Sure. Now, you mentioned it a bit earlier, but I want to kind of focus on a little more about how much of Cohen's work takes the form of polemical arguments with other major political philosophers. So in discussing that in the introduction, you talk about his kind of polemical argumentative strategy in terms of what you call an immanent approach to political philosophy. Could you explain what that means for us?
Sure, yeah. I think this is very important, not just because it helps us understand Cohen's work better, but also it's helpful for students of philosophy to understand this method better. And it's clearly the method that many 19th century philosophers used and thought was productive for writing and doing philosophy. So an immanent argument is simply an argument that grants an opponent's premises and works from these premises to conclusions that the opponent cannot accept or cannot accept costlessly. And I say that this practice of immanent critique is very, very helpful because it sort of hoists the opponent with their own petard. So it destroys the citadel from within, as it were. And Cohen, of course, utilized that method in all the main debates he was engaged in his Marxism, in his critique of Nozick's attempt to justify private property, in his polemic with Rawls and equality and egalitarianism. But also, crucially, this is the method that Karl Marx relies on when he criticizes political economy. Das Kapital is called, is subtitled, The Critique of Political Economy. And that text sets out by granting its opponents, namely the partisans of classical political economy, all their assumptions, and going from there to conclusions that they cannot costlessly accept.
Right. And I mean, something kind of implicit in that, at least to me, when I was reading your work, and I suppose this is true of Cohen's as well, is that, you know, not only can one read this book that you've written and understand Cohen a lot better, but they also learn new things about Nozick and Dworkin and Rawls and Sen and these other thinkers as well, which is, I think, of great benefit in engaging the book.
Right. Yeah. I think, well, precisely because, as I said, Cohen wasn't a system builder. He was more a reactive kind of thinker. It was much his habit was to pick up on a theory, an influential theory, which he thought or felt was mistaken, and then try relentlessly to bring it down. But bring it down not by creating scarecrow arguments and you know, weak opposition. Cohen was quite famous for raising objections to his own views that were much stronger than objections that stronger than objections his opponents raised against him, and that's something important for students of philosophy to do as well, in my opinion. You know, the stronger the opposition to your argument, the stronger your argument if it succeeds in refuting them.
Certainly. Now, one last bit of the introduction I'd like to ask you about, and that is Cohen's, as you put it, small c conservatism. Mm. And in your view, that aspect of Cohen's thinking is necessarily related to his egalitarianism. Now, why is that in your view?
So towards the end of his life, Cohen experienced the need to develop and defend a kind of disposition that he had, not in matters of justice, but in matters of everyday life. He called himself a small c conservative. That in the sense, perhaps in the human sense, that he didn't want, you know, he didn't want much change in his everyday life. He had this habit. He used to say this, that he agreed with Wittgenstein, "I don't mind what I eat as long as it's always the same." and so one of his essays, this essay, Rescuing Conservatism from the Conservatives, defends certain kinds of value, what he calls particular value, for example. And my interpretation of Cohen's defense of conservatism, which has been recently published in a wonderful volume edited by Michael Otsuka, is that he experienced this need to defend conservatism, small c conservatism, this non-political conservatism, as a kind of compensating differential for his radicalism. That is, if you have a very demanding theory of equality, if you think, as Cohen thought, that no differences in people's circumstances, that there's no differences in social class, in social background, in education, or even in talents and what's sometimes called personal resources, your IQ or your congenital capacities. If you think that none of these are the proper basis for inequality, and you think that any and all of differences and any and all the differences of this form are proper grounds for compensation, then you know it's very likely that you want to it will be very difficult for you to lead your life without constantly nagging yourself about, this is unjust, this is unfair, this should be redistributed, this should be compensated, blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, naturally, he came to the view that at least some areas of my everyday life should be somehow protected from the exigencies of justice.
Right. Now, let's perhaps move into kind of the bulk of the book itself. And I would just mark for the listeners that the way you've organized the book is to, in each chapter, kind of engage a major topic or major area of Cohen's thought, and then kind of really engage in kind of this exegesis of his work, especially as it plays out in various polemics. So I'll try to mark that as we make our way through the conversation. And in the first chapter, you're engaging Cohen's historical materialism. And so there's something interesting about Cohen's materialism that you're kind of, I think, picking up on in a very expressively, intelligent way. And that is that it's a kind of old-fashioned materialism. So maybe if I could ask you both, why Cohen's technological materialism is old-fashioned, but also why that's the kind of theory that he develops.
Yes. So technological materialism, as I said, is the old-fashioned, it's old-fashioned in the sense that it's the view of it's the Marxism of the Second International. The Second International, in case listeners need some refreshing of their historical memory in this matter, the Second International was the biggest federation of socialist parties in Europe at the end of 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. The biggest figures of European social democracy were members of the Second International: Kautsky, Bernstein, Mehring, Bebel. All these people who were either sat at Marx's feet or Engels's feet, defended this form of materialism. So in that sense, it's old-fashioned. And what that materialism maintains is that there's a tripartite distinction that ought to be drawn if we want to explain what explains what in historical development. And this tripartite distinction is the one between productive forces, roughly technology, relations of production, roughly relations of power in society, and superstructure, roughly the state and the law. And the claim, the explanatory claim that these people affirmed was that the productive forces explain the relations of production, and then the relations of production explain the superstructure. This is the characteristic mark of the Marxism of the Second International, and this is the Marxism that Cohen defends. But of course, Cohen adds a couple of things to this. First of all, his 1978 book, Karl Marx's Theory of History and Defense, is the first attempt ever by an analytical philosopher to defend the Marxism of the Second International rigorously and give it a rigorous formulation. And secondly, he enlists a number of techniques from biology and scientific, a number of methods used in mainstream science. He enlists them for the purposes of providing Marxism, as he puts it, with micro foundations.
Right. Now, we could, I imagine, have a whole hour-long conversation just about his materialism and the way you reconstruct it in the book, but perhaps kind of pick out one particular aspect of it. One of the moves that Cohen makes is the claim that productive forces have an autonomous tendency to develop throughout history. Could you perhaps kind of explicate that claim from Cohen as you understand it?
Yeah. So this is a fundamental premise in the argument for the explanatory primacy of the productive forces over the relations of production, that is, of technology over power relations. And this premise, Cohen calls it the development thesis. And the development thesis, which, as you put it, maintains that the productive forces develop autonomously, rather, they have an autonomous tendency to develop, follows from certain claims about, according to Cohen, human rationality. So the idea is that if people find themselves in a situation of scarcity, and if in this situation they can improve their own lot by improving their tools or by improving their know-how so that they can extract a bigger surplus from the land, for example, they will tend to do so. And Cohen further claims that not only is this a priori claim true about all rational beings, whenever and wherever situated, but also it is borne out by the historical data. He thinks that there is plenty of empirical evidence to show that the productive forces have developed throughout history, and this is what explains relations of power rather than vice versa. Of course, these are all controversial claims, some of which have been explicitly and extensively discussed and rebutted by other philosophers and also by historians.
Right. As we move on to chapter 2, where you engage the concept of freedom in Cohen's work, why is it that, as you claim in the chapter, Cohen's theory of freedom helps kind of bridge Cohen's Marxism with his normative political philosophy?
Yeah, that's a great, great question. So, one of the main axiological, let's say, or evaluative aspects of Cohen's Marxism is to understand, and of course this is prevalent not only in Cohen's work, of course this is also Hegel and Marx, is to understand what freedom is and how freedom develops throughout history. So In a number of his early Marxist works, writings, Cohen explicitly mentions freedom as a basic motivation for his trying to defend historical materialism. It's it's an attempt to unearth the historical presuppositions of the culmination of human freedom that is supposed to arrive when socialism overcomes capitalism. Now, Cohen says explicitly that once he had published Karl Marx's Theory of History, he felt a sense of liberation. He had the sense that it was now up to him to work on these evaluative or axiological presuppositions of his theory of history, or rather these topics that motivated his discussion of Marx, And this is what he proceeds to do in response to numerous objections raised against his reconstruction of Marx after 1978. So between 78 and I'd say 1993, 1994, Cohen spends most of his time thinking about freedom, how this connects with Marxism, and how it also connects with other debates in contemporary political philosophy, including debates that claim against Marxism that private property is justified.
Right, and even somewhat of, kind of in tandem with the critique of private property is also a critique by Cohen of money in this effort to, as you say, as you put it on page 39, rescue the idea of freedom from appropriation by the pro-capitalist right. So maybe even before we get into the critique of private property, could you walk us a bit through Cohen's critique of money and the implications of that for the concept of freedom?
Yeah. Cohen discusses money in connection with what I think is a brilliant, imminent, again, critique of Isaiah Berlin. So the critique is imminent because Cohen grants his opponent, in this case Berlin, his premise, namely the liberal idea that freedom just is the absence of external interference with action. It's absence of external impediment to doing what you might want to do. Cohen grants this premise. But unlike many liberals like Berlin and like, for that matter, John Rawls, Cohen says that even on this claim, it does not follow that money does not, even on the this so-called negative conception of freedom, it does not follow that money does not deprive people of freedom. That is, lack of money does not deprive you of freedom as money does deprive you of freedom as unlike what these liberals maintain. So, for example, Rawls thinks that to lack money is a bit like the lack of wings, for instance, right? So to lack wings is not to lack freedom to fly. It's merely to lack the means to fly. By the same token, Rawls and some of his moods Berlin claim that to lack money is not to lack freedom to buy stuff. It's merely lack of means. And so what Cohen does in this context is question this inference. He points out that when you go out into some store to buy a sweater, if you lack money and you just try to remove the item of consumption from the shelf, you will normally be subject to interference by the store owner or by their the police or by some private security agency and so on. So to lack money is to lack freedom, even on the liberal conception of freedom, says Cohen. And this has important implications for how we should see and approach poverty, even if we stick to a very narrow and traditional, let's say, account of freedom.
Certainly, and that's a particularly kind of vivid example of Cohen's method of imminent critique and the power of that kind of argument. And there's another argument that you're going over in this chapter, and that is Cohen's argument with Nozick. And here, could you walk us through the way that Cohen ends up claiming against Nozick that private property constitutes a restriction of freedom?
Yes, so Cohen arrives at his critique of Nozick through a slightly convoluted path, because originally what Cohen is concerned with is to show that on the liberal conception of, on the negative conception of freedom that I just mentioned, private property restricts freedom. So, you know, on the conception of freedom which maintains that I'm free if and only if I'm not subject to or liable to external interference, Cohen points out that if I pitch my tent in your backyard, I'll normally be liable to interference. You'll call the police or you'll interfere with me and so on. So Cohen maintains that private property is a distribution of freedom and non-freedom in the negative sense. Now, in light of this objection, many liberals, sometimes called libertarians, a subset of liberals who call themselves libertarians, they respond that this isn't the right conception of freedom. Freedom is not about liability to interference. Freedom is about what rights people have. So they respond by moralizing the conception, the relevant conception of freedom. And so what Cohen does in response to that is he asks, what kind of right is that and what are its contents? I mean, why is private property, to take the standard case, not a form of theft? And a lot of Cohen's work after 1992-93, after Marxism begins to recede and his interests in mainstream moral and political philosophy begin to come to the fore, consists in actually buttressing this claim that private property is a form of theft.
Thank you. Now, if we turn now to chapter 3, you kind of really dig into this question of equality through, in my reading at least, kind of three of Cohen's different polemics. So maybe we can kind of take them one by one. And the first of these is the question about how does Cohen's debate with Dworkin on the pattern of justice kind of help illuminate Cohen's theory?
Yeah, what I'll do is maybe I'll just say a little bit more about the theft bit.
Sure.
Because it connects nicely with your question about equality. So Cohen wants to reappropriate this slogan, Proudhon's slogan that private property is theft. And in order to develop this and buttress this claim, we need a theory, Cohen claims, of the just distribution of stuff. We need a theory of what counts as justice in the distribution of the objects of the external world. And so once Nozickian, let's say the advocate of libertarianism, has raised this moralized, broached this moralized conception of freedom, the conception of freedom that's founded on rights, the socialist needs to come up with an alternative theory of what rights we have to chunks of the external world. And so the debate on egalitarianism and on the nature of distributive justice is crucial for Cohen because it's crucial for vindicating his opposition to the libertarian. It's if we're egalitarians, we need an alternative theory of distribution. And so this is what Cohen's theory of equality does end of the 1980s and mid 1990s, Cohen develops this theory along with Ronald Dworkin and some other philosophers like Richard Arneson that later came to be called luck egalitarianism. I won't say very much about this, save for specifying the theory. The theory says that a distribution of chunks of the external world, of external resources, is just if and only if it reflects nothing but differences in responsibility or choice. And that theory has pretty radical implications in all kinds of dimensions. I also think it backfires against Cohen, but maybe this is a topic for another time.
Hmm. So if that's kind of one aspect of Cohen's theory of distributive justice, there's also the issue of what the metric of justice is to be. And yeah. Here it seems to me that Cohen's response is a response, on the one hand, to utilitarians, as many engaged in these debates are responding to. Mm-hmm. Then it's also a response to Amartya Sen's capabilities approach. So what's Cohen's kind of critique, particularly of Sen, in this debate?
Yes. So when we talk about metrics, so the issue here is, what is it that egalitarians should be concerned to distribute? And utilitarians normally maintain that egalitarians should be concerned to equalize either people's utility or welfare, however that's measured, in objective terms or subjective terms or in terms of preferences and so on. Amartya Sen famously criticizes utilitarians because Sen claims, and I think he's right, and Cohen also thinks he is right, that utilitarians are exclusively concerned with what goods do to people, and especially not just what goods do to people, but what goods do to people's mental states, their states of welfare or psychological states in general. Whereas Sen maintains that we should be interested and concerned with what people can do with goods. So we shouldn't be fetishistic about welfare. We should think about and be concerned with what people can do with goods as opposed to what goods do to people. Cohen agrees with this, but he also maintains that Sen's view is too monistic. That is, there is this famous example, the Tiny Tim example that's being used in this debate. So Tiny Tim from Dickens's Christmas Carol. Tiny Tim, Sen says, Tiny Tim has a sunny disposition. So even if he's disabled, but he has a sunny disposition, so even if he's not provided with a wheelchair, he still has a pretty high level of welfare. But Sen says, if we're egalitarians, we should be concerned with what Tiny Tim can do with his life and what he can do with goods. So we should provide him with a wheelchair. He should have the capability of moving around, being mobile, and so on. Cohen agrees with this, but he thinks that it matters, and it matters in addition to what Sen says, that Tiny Tim not only be able to move around, but also to being around to move painlessly. So it's not just what people can do with goods that matters, but it's also what goods do to people that matters. And we should try to incorporate both the welfarist and the capabilitarian dimension of concern in one metric, which Cohen calls advantage.
Thank you. Very helpful kind of elucidation of that. And now there's kind of a third dimension of a theory of distributive justice, and that is what the site of justice is to be. Right. And here you trace and further kind of develop a very interesting move that Cohen makes, and that is to kind of take off from the feminist insight that the personal is political to end up in a critique of Rawls regarding the proper site of justice. So could you perhaps trace us through those steps that Cohen makes?
Sure, yeah. So Rawls's political philosophy, Rawls's theory of justice, has this famous interpretation of the distinction between public and private. Rawls claims that what he calls the primary subject of justice is to be restricted to the basic structure of society. So the basic structure of society is its fundamental, publicly accessible and observable institutional features. And so what Cohen does is effectively he, again, through an immanent critique, he tries to show that Rawls's delineation of this distinction, basic versus non-basic structure, is completely arbitrary. And he does this by appropriating, as you said, the feminist slogan, the personal is political. So roughly, Cohen's criticism of Rawls goes as follows. He says, Cohen asks, which aspects of society fall under what Rawls calls the basic structure? Do non-coercive institutions such as the family come under the purview of the basic structure? The answer that Rawls gives in a kind of half-hearted way is, yeah, well, the family affects the distribution of burdens between men and women, for example. So, sure, the family does come under the basic structure. But if that is the case, then Rawls finds himself in a slippery slope, because now he cannot exclude certain things that he ostensibly wants to exclude, like things like instances of personal or non-coercively enforced or non-coercively enforceable personal behavior. So what Cohen ends up doing here is say that Rawls's delineation of the basic structure is arbitrary, and that by implication, a just society is one that would have not just justice in its institutions, but also justice in citizens. A just society would, as a necessary condition, require an ethos of justice in citizens who would behave according to the demands of justice, and this follows on Rawls's own terms. So again, this is Cohen's imminent critique, an imminent argument in full swing, and it's very damaging to Rawls's edifice, I think.
Certainly. And now, one thing that you note kind of towards the end of the third chapter is that there are some tensions in Cohen's thought between his egalitarianism and his theory of justice on the one hand and his Marxism on the other. Could you perhaps map out some of those tensions for us?
Yes. Well, Cohen, as I said, in the 1990s, Cohen's Marxism goes in the background. In fact, Cohen himself spends a lot of time criticizing his earlier views without abandoning Marxism strictly, but criticizes his views of Marx and his reconstruction of Marx's theory of history in a number of occasions. But what's especially striking, and I mentioned this in the book, but it's interesting that very few people have actually seen this, which is that Cohen's early work attaches explanatory primacy to material features of society, the relations of production, or more importantly, the productive forces. But now in Cohen's later work, there's a kind of explanatory inversion. That is, it's ethos and spiritual phenomena, like people's dispositions to equality, for example, or hegemony, if you want to use a Gramscian term, that come to seem to be in the driving seat as opposed to material features. And this kind of tension in his early work, the focus on the explanatory primacy of the material, as opposed to in his later work, the explanatory primacy, or what seems to be the explanatory primacy of the spiritual, this tension is never really resolved in Cohen's work or by Cohen, partly because, as I said in the beginning, he wasn't concerned with building a unified structure. It was more ad hominem, the kinds of debates he was interested in.
Right, and I'm going to, for time purposes, perhaps skip over chapter 4, although I would mark for the listeners that there's both a kind of fascinating explication of Cohen's account of exploitation against the way that some Marxists use the labor theory of value to mm-hmm. explain exploitation, and then also a very kind of thoughtful, incisive critique by you of the way that Cohen sometimes links justice and exploitation. So I'd mark that those, that's kind of two very, very important and very interesting aspects of chapter 4. And now if we turn then to chapter 5 instead, and so whereas in the third chapter on equality, you note these kind of tensions with his Marxism, when it comes to the issue of community in chapter 5, you note some parallels between Marx and Cohen.
Right. Yeah, so what's happening here is that Cohen, in his later work, especially, well, so Cohen published, Cohen's last published work is a little essay entitled Why Not Socialism? It was published in September 2009, 1 month after Jerry passed. And so that book enunciates a kind of ideal community and attempts to figure out what kind of social relations we would want to engage in if we were producing together. So how, in what communal structure would joint production require if we were to produce together, treating one another as human beings? And Cohen claims that it would have the structure of the production within the context of an egalitarian community of human beings would look more like a world, like a well-ordered camping trip than like a capitalist workhouse. And so the notion of community that comes to the fore here is, as you point out, similar to a lot of things that Marx says in Capital, but also in his early writings, especially the texts, the Paris manuscripts, and the comments on James Mill. And Cohen's exegesis of these forms of community is that is consists in what he calls communal reciprocity. So communal reciprocity is this ideal in which people serve one another and are in turn served, but not through the motives of fear and greed. Fear and greed, in Cohen's opinion, is a dominant motivating feature of capitalist social relations, and it is an abhorrent feature of our motivational landscape, as it were, and a truly communal society, a society that valued egalitarianism within the context of community, a form of flourishing in community with others, would get rid of fear and greed. And it, in order to do that, it would have to get rid of at least some forms of market relations.
Right. And so if that's kind of one track that the argument in Chapter 5 is running on. Mm-hmm. Another is kind of re-engaging the debate between Cohen and Rawls. And it seems to me that there are perhaps also some resonances between the way Cohen critiques Rawls on the question of the site of justice and the development mm-hmm. of this notion of the need for some sort of ethos or orientation to justice.
Mm-hmm.
And then his critique of Rawls when it comes to issues of community or fraternity.
Right, yeah. So you're right that there's at least two strands in Cohen's account of community. One is what I just explained, the account of communal reciprocity. And another is, again, this imminent critique of Rawls, not this time on Rawls's delineation of the basic structure, but rather on Rawls's explicit claims to the effect that his theory of justice expresses a form of fraternity. And what Cohen does here is effectively he keeps pulling Rawls to the left. So he keeps nagging Rawls to explicate and further develop his account of equality. And Cohen very clearly and, in my opinion, brilliantly brings out a kind of ambiguity in Rawls's theory of equality. So Cohen tries to show that certain forms of equality that Rawlsian liberalism tends to tolerate, such as, for example, the inequalities that are due to differences in talent, cannot be sustained by Rawls's own lights. So the talented person who asks for a higher rate of return in the market without being willing to increase his contribution for the benefit of the less well-off is relevantly, thinks Cohen, like the kidnapper who says to the parents of the child he has abducted that, you know, children should be with their parents. Unless you pay me, I won't return your child, so you should pay me. Cohen maintains that this incentive structure is similar to the structure of markets in which talented people ask for very high rewards without accepting that they will pay a significant part as taxes. And this follows by Rawls's own lights, by Rawls's own commitments.
Right, and thank you for that. And the final chapter of the book is titled Socialism in the Market. And here there are a number of kind of interesting aspects at work. One is a critique of markets in general, but also Cohen's critique of market socialism. And then also you trace his argument for planning. But perhaps rather than asking you to kind of get into the nitty-gritty of each of those arguments, I was hoping you maybe would perhaps speculate as to kind of the importance of turning to Cohen's socialism or to Cohen more broadly in kind of current political and economic conditions as a way to kind of start to conclude the interview.
Yes. Well, the last chapter of the book is the most speculative one because it tries to bring together different strands of Cohen's political thought together and see what comes out of them. And Cohen has a number of distinct critiques of the market, of commodification, the commodification of labor power, and so on. I think there's numerous strands that might be worth thinking about here, but perhaps the most important has to do with the connection between egalitarianism or equality and community in Cohen's later work, and especially this notion of communal reciprocity, that markets of necessity compel people to see one another either as sources of enrichment or as possible threats to their own well-being. And insofar as Cohen is right about that, there's an important lacuna, if you like, in contemporary political thought that are attempting to buttress and understand this set of values. Now, vis-a-vis contemporary stuff and the situation we find ourselves in today, I think the most useful takeaway, take-home messages from Cohen's political philosophy are his ad hominem critiques. So the ad hominem critique of Isaiah Berlin, stuff on money that we mentioned, the discussion of private property and how privatization, privatizing stuff just diminishes people's liberty, at least on the negative conception of liberty. And if it does not, if liberty isn't about being liable to interference, but rather it's about what rights we have, then we need to be told more about what these rights are. And Cohen has, along with many egalitarians, a theory of what the just distribution of stuff is supposed to be. And also his imminent critiques of Rawls, which I think will stand the test of time as a kind of left critique of liberalism.
Thank you. Now, but before we say goodbye, I was wondering if perhaps there's anything we didn't get the chance to cover in our conversation that you'd like to highlight for the listeners.
I don't think so. What I would like to mention and point out is, for people who are interested in political philosophy or learning it, or students in political philosophy and so on, I couldn't think of a better teacher, but also of a better teacher in the sense that someone whose writings can help you understand what a debate is about, but also how to do and write political philosophy. I mean, the guy was a model of clarity and intellectual integrity. And so even people who disagree with him, I think will find much in Cohen's work that will help them both understand more things about political philosophy, but also develop their own way of thinking and writing about these things.
No, I would certainly second that, and it's that kind of analytical rigor, both in Cohen's work and your own, certainly shines through in the book. So I'll ask you now the traditional concluding question of the podcast, and that is, what are you currently working on?
I'm during my time at Princeton, I'm writing a book. I'm here to write a book on exploitation, so I'm writing a book tentatively entitled How Exploiters Dominate, and it's about the connection between exploitation and power. And it's relevant in a sense to what the Cohen book did, because this book is a kind of attempt to complete my parasite, as it were, that is, to completely move the debate on exploitation away from stuff on unfairness and distributive justice, and more in the plant it more firmly in the direction or in the landscape of power, domination, and cognate ideas and concepts.
All right. Well, thank you for that, and Nicholas, thank you so much for joining us on New Books in Global Ethics and Politics.
Thanks very much. It's been a great pleasure.